So I think now, because psychedelics are coming back, there are more and more people who are beginning to recognize that our sense of reality is a construction, and it's relatively easy to disrupt that construction and begin to experience all kinds of other things. So fortunately, there are enough studies now showing that psychedelics are useful for treating depression and other psychiatric problems, that it won't go away this time. It'll still be controlled in some way because it's powerful stuff, but nevertheless, it won't be abused and controlled like it was back in the 60s. Well, so that opens that, combined with meditation going mainstream, both of those are causing more and more people to directly experience that, not only just psychic things that happen spontaneously, but other things that happen and increasingly as a result of mentally being in different spaces.
Hello, everybody. I'm thrilled to introduce my guest today, Dr. Dean Radin. Welcome to the show, Dean.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Did I use the right title there, Doctor? I get confused sometimes because there are so many titles. Are you a professor, perhaps?
I am, but people just call me Dean, so that's fine.
Excellent. I love that. But your resume is so impressive that it's not really possible to do it justice here. You have had a very long academic career. I'll just try to summarize a little bit here. You've written 4 books as well, called The Conscious Universe, Entangled Minds, Supernormal, Real Magic. And you've written some 150 academic articles. You've given hundreds of talks for the U.S. government and for the various international governments. You've made innumerable interviews and TV appearances. A German magazine named you as one of the 100 most inspiring people in the world. But the short version that might help the audience to grasp where we will be heading in this conversation is that you, for over 3 decades, have been engaged in research on the frontiers of consciousness, particularly what is referred to as paranormal phenomena, or PSI, PSI, as it's spelled. So you're the chief scientist of IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Did I get that about right?
That is correct, except now it's actually 4 decades, not 3 decades.
Okay, so it's 4 decades. But you started your career as far as I understand, as an engineer. Were you always interested in the so-called paranormal, even back then?
Well, actually, starting my career with degrees in electrical engineering and psychology. So officially, I was working on human factors, mainly human-computer interaction. That was like my first job at Bell Laboratories. But I've always had an interest in consciousness, and in particular psychic phenomena, because of the challenge of those kinds of experiences for our understanding of the mind and consciousness. So even at Bell Labs, actually everywhere that I've worked in academia and in industry, I've always been using a part of my time or full time studying various kinds of psychic effects.
Okay. So it goes way back then. Does everybody use psychic abilities all the time, unknowingly, would you say?
I think there's fairly good evidence that these kinds of experiences bubble up from the unconscious, and as such, that people are not exactly using, but the information is available all the time. In the modern world, we don't need to pay much attention to these kinds of impressions because they tend to be subtle for most people. Others who we tend to call psychic, those kinds of people, some people are talented in this domain, they simply have better access to that kind of information. But most of the time in the laboratory, if we take unselected participants and we ask them to do something psychic in the lab consciously, they can't do it very well. They're pretty close to chance. If, on the other hand, we measure unconscious behavior, usually physiological behavior, like some aspect of their central nervous system or autonomic nervous system, you find even that unselected people will do fairly well in an experiment. So that's why we suspect that whatever is the source of this information, most people have it going on in their unconscious, whether they, of course, by definition, they wouldn't know it. Because it's in their unconscious.
But would you say that there are some people who actually don't have it at all? Or would that be completely abnormal?
There are people who I would call psi blind, that their conscious experience, they tend not to have these experiences. And so they're just as there are people who are talented and do have conscious experiences, there are people on the other side too who tend to not have it. So from a psychological perspective, this is not surprising because people are different. People have different capacities.
Yeah. Well, I kind of find it fascinating that some people that I know tell me that they never dream or they never remember dreams, for instance. I mean, that's just one aspect of this, but I find that very strange because, I mean, I remember dreams every morning. They're not always interesting, but it's like they say, oh, I just wake up and it's been all black for the whole night. And to me, it's just, what?
Yeah. I actually rarely remember my dreams.
Okay.
Although I know that if I intend to remember them, especially by writing them down as soon as I get up, then I'll remember them. But otherwise, it fades very quickly.
Yeah, it fades. But then you have a sense that there was something there.
Yeah.
Often
we'll have a sense that something was there, and then I'll even try to remember it before I'm fully awake. Still fades away.
Yeah, I know that's for sure. That's true for me as well. They fade away very quickly, and if you don't write them down or something. So, would you say that paranormal phenomena are the same thing as spiritual phenomena?
Well, I don't like the word paranormal when referring to these experiences because the paranormal covers such a huge range of things that are strange, that we don't understand very well, that it tends to collapse psychic experiences, which are fairly common, into search for Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster. And I've actually been in meetings with scientists who, and someone says, oh, well, Dean is a parapsychologist. And then somebody says, oh, what does that mean? And before I have a chance to respond, they'll say, oh, it's searching for Bigfoot. Well, no, it's not that. I think it's perfectly valid to look for creatures like Bigfoot, if such a thing exists, but it's a very, very different kind of category because Bigfoot is generally not part of people's experience. Maybe it's a mythology, we don't know. But psychic experiences, synchronicities, that sort of thing, are extremely common. So, and not only that, the experiences are perfectly amenable to being studied using scientific methods. Whereas I suppose in principle, we could do the same thing for Bigfoot, but it would require a huge amount of people and money and satellites and who knows what to find it. And there isn't that much interest in it because it seems to be pretty rare.
Yeah. Whereas the other thing is ubiquitous in all of us.
Yeah, a common experience. And so as a psychologist, we're interested in experience, especially this particular experience, because it doesn't seem to fit our current understanding or current scientific understanding of what should be allowed, like what's possible. The most common complaint or criticism that I run up against is from people who don't have these experiences and then say they are impossible or that they're misinterpreted or they're coincidence or maybe they're fraud. And so, just like you mentioned that there are people who never remember their dreams, if their internal experience is telling them people don't dream, you know, they project their own experience onto everybody else. Well, in this case, enough people that they know and trust would say, yeah, we really do have dreams. Maybe they would believe it. But in this case, if somebody never had a synchronicity, they never had anything they consider to be psychic, and they then look in the scientific literature and see lots of uncertainty, they would say, it probably is impossible. It isn't what people think it is.
Yeah. And My question also contained this concept of spirituality. Is it the same thing, would you say? Is it, I mean, let's not talk about paranormal phenomena then, but unusual normal phenomena that we are talking about here, like synchronicities, like premonitions, precognition, perhaps. Are they akin to spiritual experiences, or are those different things? How would you define it?
I would say there's an overlap. So spiritual experiences, if you ask 100 people what they mean by spiritual, you'll get 100 different answers. Mm. So it's not all that clear about what people think they mean. But in general, spiritual for many people means something bigger, something larger about reality than we're used to in our everyday awareness. So some people will interpret that in religious terms, some in the terms of the supernatural, perhaps, or divinity. Others will simply say, no, I felt a very strange, intimate sense of connection with other people or with things elsewhere. Well, that's where the overlap with psychic experience is very clear. So one of the ways I describe this when people ask this very question is, spirituality suggests a deep interconnectedness among all things. Well, that is a way of describing what psychic phenomena are like, because we're interconnected somehow with our minds and somehow through space and somehow through time. So that too is suggesting some kind of a deep interconnectedness, but usually without the connotation that it involves the divine. Because almost by definition, the divine is outside of the natural world, supernatural. And science can say nothing about that because we can only study the natural world.
That's also a question. Is it possible to draw a line between science and spirituality? Because it's actually an interesting time now, because the research into consciousness, what consciousness is, and we might come back to that, is getting more and more intense, and they're kind of touching on the borderlines here, on the intersection between what you might call spirituality and science. So would you say it's possible to draw a line and say that this is science and this is spirituality, and never shall the twain meet?
No, I would say it's a spectrum. Yeah, there's a spectrum here, and where the line is drawn is arbitrary based on, I guess, each person's idea. I tend not to draw that line, because I would say then that there's an overlap. There's overlap between what people think about spirituality and think about consciousness or human experience. And where the overlap is going to be slightly different for each person. But as I said before, the commonality is a feeling of interconnectedness that transcends the everyday sense of who and what you are.
Mm. Well, you mentioned synchronicities. I would say that when you have a very strong synchronicity, you have a feeling at the same time, a sense of deep meaningfulness, because, something is synchronistic, happens just before a very pivotal event of some kind. You kind of intuitively connect the two, and it's very difficult to explain to others when you haven't. You have to experience it yourself, but it gives you a very deep sense of meaning somehow. So that's spiritual, right? Way.
Yeah. Well, and a synchronicity is defined as a coincidence that has meaning.
Yeah.
Right. It's not like it's not dumb luck. It's the equivalent of smart luck. It's like something happened, but it is personally meaningful. And it's true that if somebody else doesn't get the meaning, then they'll say, well, that's just a coincidence. That's meaningless to them. But to you, of course, it could be extremely meaningful. And occasionally people will have synchronicities that are so meaningful that it's obvious to everyone. Things that are extremely unlikely to occur by chance. And in many ways, the kind of research that I do attempts to evoke synchronicities in the laboratory. That's essentially what our lab studies are all about.
Okay, so can you elaborate on that?
So let's say we're studying telepathy. So the design of the experiment is that you take a pair of people and you give one of them some kind of a target system, a randomly selected image or something, and then the other person attempts to describe that. So if you're lucky, you'll have the synchronicity where the receiving party will in fact describe what the sending party is sending mentally. And of course, it's very strictly controlled, so there's no ordinary way that information can transfer. But what you see at the result at the end of this is a coincidence. You see, I gave the sender this image, and by coincidence, the receiving party got it. Well, that's meaningful now because I set it up in advance, right? I didn't know what picture I was going to use, but I set up the correlation in advance, and it's a positive correlation. So we can then say then that this was a kind of synchronicity. There's a correlation that arose. It's meaningful both to the participants and to me. And so it's a synchronicity, but we created it.
Yeah.
So the difference then between a spontaneous synchronicity in somebody's life and what we see in the laboratory is not really that far off.
No, you're right. It isn't.
The main difference is that in the laboratory, we know the a priori probability of that coincidence. You see, if you did one test of telepathy where the chance of getting it right is 1 in 4, so you could have it purely by chance. And so that would not be considered, if you use that as your total evidence for telepathy and somebody got the 1 in 4 correct, people would say, well, that could be a coincidence. So who cares? But if you do that 5,000 times with lots of different pairs of people and lots of laboratories around the world and you don't get 1 in 4, you get more like 1 in 3, then it's extremely unlikely to have occurred by chance. And that's roughly the results that we see after doing, I don't know, 50 years worth of experiments like this using the same design. So that's how we know that these evoked synchronicities in a laboratory are not coincidence. There is a correlation, but the correlation is far from chance.
Yeah, but still there are some skeptics, and we get back to that. Now, you do all kinds of experiments and trials at IONS. You mentioned telepathy here. And there is one ongoing right now, as far as I understand. So tell us a bit more about that. It's called the Sigil experiment, or Sigil experiments, which is an acronym for Scientific Investigation of Gazing with Intuition at Light. That sounds very interesting and intriguing. And it hasn't begun as yet, has it? Or it's
oh, no.
Underway.
Yeah, it's begun. And the idea of this is testing the quantum observer effect.
Yeah, okay.
It's so one of the interpretations of quantum mechanics is that there's something unusual about observation / measurement of a quantum system that causes the elementary quanta to change their behavior. So we've done over more than a decade now, something like 24 experiments using a optical double slit system, where rather than observing the interference pattern with your eye, you mentally observe it. You use your mind's eye to imagine that you could see what the photons are doing inside the double slit system. And so we know that if you put a photodetector there and the photodetector can tell where the photons are going, that causes a change. So there's big debates within physics as to what is the meaning of measurement.
Yeah, there's a Copenhagen interpretation, isn't it?
It's yes, among other things, yes. So John von Neumann and others had said that that the act of measurement requires consciousness, that there needs to be something that's conscious of the measurement in order for it to so-called collapse the wave function. So it would be tempting to then say, well, let's create a system where you can look through a microscope somehow and see with your eye what's going on inside the system. But that wouldn't work. And von Neumann and others knew it wouldn't work because every step along the way then, your eye, your brain, the microscope, everything else, it's all physical systems, in which case everything remains in a superposition and nothing is measured. So it requires something like an act of subjective awareness of what's going on, which is non-physical, Right? It's correlated with brain activity, but it's not a physical thing when you have an internal experience. Maybe that's the thing that so-called breaks the chain and causes the measurement to actually occur. And of course, this goes way back to an old philosophical question of if a tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like that. So the answer would be no, and because a sound has a very specific meaning in terms of our internal experience of it. If you ask the question, if a tree falls in the forest, does it create reverberations in the density of air? Well, then you can say, yeah, but that's not exactly a sound. A sound is what we experience. So we've done 24 experiments, and there's a number of other laboratories have done similar studies suggesting that if you mentally imagine that you can get the information, you're extracting information out of a quantum system, the behavior does change. To a small extent, but to the degree to which you can gain the information. The sigil experiment was designed to encourage people to replicate this study, because if the results are replicated in lots of different laboratories, it directly informs an outstanding and longstanding problem in the interpretation of quantum mechanics. So I wanted to create a way that was easy for people to replicate this experiment. And that means that especially among my colleagues who may be psychologists and don't know about optical physics, and they don't have the apparatus, and they don't have the money, and they don't have anything. So I wanted to create an interferometer. So this is an example of the interferometer. It's just a little box. It's an optical system with lots of other sensors in it, and they plug it into the computer. And then the software will talk you through the experiment. So I made 50 of these things, and I did a long-term process to select people who may have talent in this domain. And the reason why I chose the word sigil is because that is a common magical practice. People doing esoteric magic use a sigil. It's a symbol.
Yeah, yeah. It's not just an acronym. It's an actual.
Yeah, it's a meaningful acronym. So it's a synchronicity, but a design synchronicity.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I sent this out to 50 people, and so far almost 30 have finished their pre-registered sequence of sessions that they would run, and so I'm giving to the end of April. Of this year to get all of the data, and then however much I get at that point, we just stop it. So I'm hoping I'll get maybe 40 of the 50 people to have finished by then. And the results are not based on a double slit system, but on a diffraction system, but it still involves photon interference. So I have a way of measuring the degree to which there is interference happening inside the optical box. And then people are asked to mentally pay attention to what's going on inside the box because they're getting real-time feedback, and then to withdraw their mind from that. And so it's the differential comparison and the amount of interference that we're looking at. So it's been underway since the beginning of March. And so over the 2 months, we'll end up with all of the data. And the results are, the analyses are pre-registered, and the data is encrypted, and there's lots of bells and whistles involved in the experiment to give high confidence that whatever the results end up being, that we can believe it.
Okay, but you haven't been able to look into the results as yet.
I've done preliminary analysis, and so far it looks very good, but we're only about 60% of the data at this point. If the remainder of the data continues to look that way, then it will be very interesting.
So what's
it'll be interesting either way, actually. It doesn't matter the results will be whatever they are.
Yeah.
And I'd be happy if the results ended up being consistent with what I see so far, but I don't know what the results will be yet.
Yeah, true. I mean, that's true science. Follow the evidence wherever they lead.
Right.
Why use photons and light? Is that because that's the easiest form of the easiest quantum particle to measure, to assess in this way? I mean, you could use some other kinds of quantum particles to see if they can change their behavior when conscious minds are involved.
Yeah, the use of photons is convenient and relatively cheap as compared to something like electrons.
Yeah.
Because it's true, you could use, there's a huge range of things that could be used.
Yeah, bosons but, or I don't know.
Yeah, even atoms or even molecules can be done. Yeah. Except it becomes more and more difficult to measure pure quantum effects the moment you start stepping away from these. And anyway, there's so much instrumentation that's available to measure light, photons.
Okay.
That it just becomes much easier. So each one of these boxes that I built costs $150 in parts. So it's relatively cheap. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to make 50 of them.
I understand.
Whereas by comparison, in the laboratory, when we use a double slit system, the cheapest one we were able to make was $10,000. And most of them are roughly in the vicinity of around $30,000. So then if we're lucky, we have a budget to make one of them. And then that defeats the purpose of trying to get large-scale replication. So the boxes, I think, are good enough to be able to measure what I'm looking at. Ideally, we'd have a budget that's 10 or 100 times larger, in which case I would just send everybody a double slit system, a properly designed one, but they're expensive.
Mm. Yeah, the objective is, of course, as you say, to find out whatever comes out of this. But as far as I understand, there have been many experiments of this kind conducted over the decades, and they tend to show, most of them show, that there is some kind of interference, that consciousness has some kind of effect of what these photons are up to. So is the objective then to either just corroborate what we already know, or maybe to find out that there's actually not this going on, there's something else?
It is true that the study of mind interacting with electrons in the form of random number generators, that's been going on for 50 years. And I believe the evidence overall is pretty good that there is some kind of an interaction happening. But this doesn't bubble up into the realm of where physicists start getting excited about it, because they can think of a million reasons why they shouldn't believe it. And so the evidence disappears. So the reason why I switched over to a very similar kind of design, but using photons in an interference context, is because physicists immediately do understand why that's relevant. It's relevant directly to an outstanding problem in physics. So this is a study looking at a psi phenomenon, but it's relevant. It's understandably and easily understandable relevance to an interpretation of quantum mechanics. Well, these other studies are too, except that it's not something that a physicist would generally work with. They don't work with things like Zener diode noise, which is the source typically of a random number generator, even though it is directly relevant. But it's not the sort of thing that they are used to.
Okay, so the objective is.
Go ahead.
Part of the objective is then to maybe, if it shows that consciousness has some role in this, to convince physicists that this is actually a thing, that this is real.
Yeah, I don't know about the word convince, but at least to bring to their awareness that there is a way of studying this particular interpretation of quantum mechanics. We can inform it empirically. And while this issue has been raised, you can see in the literature for many years, people are saying, how would we ever study if consciousness actually really is important in this? Well, that's what we've been doing for many, many years, except that you need to talk the language of the people who are asking the question. Otherwise, they don't get it, or it's not real for them. This is not true across the board, by the way, among physicists, because I know many of them who are very interested in all of this. I'm talking about how do you then penetrate into the mainstream conversation here? And this is true actually for a lot of the other psi experiments that we do, that we can easily talk to the public about this because they have these same experiences, whether it's a precognitive dream or telepathy or whatever it happens to be. And that's useful. I mean, people are interested, but we're also scientists and we want to engage into larger questions in science. And so we have to use a different narrative, a different way of approaching other scientists so that they don't simply dismiss it out of hand and can pay attention then to what we're saying because it has meaning for science.
You mentioned that consciousness could perhaps affect or could probably affect even atoms and molecules, not just quantum particles. But I mean, it could probably also then affect larger entities, larger subsections of matter, like the human body, like cells in the body. And I'm thinking of the placebo effect. Have you conducted any trials, experiments to that effect of that kind, where it's more like a medical trial, I guess, but the placebo effect is super interesting in this context because it shows that mind can actually affect how cells work in the body and it can, reverse illness and everything. Have you done anything like that at
the IELTS? Yeah, so there are two ways of doing that. One is that the target system is something like cell culture or human physiology. So both of those have been looked at in great detail over the past century or so. And so can we see in cell cultures differences in the growth of cells, depending on what people are beaming mentally at them? And the answer is yes. We also see it in growth of plants, in the structure of water, in a very wide range of different kinds of targets. Some of the targets are more difficult to measure than others, depending on what the outcome is that you're looking at. But for everything from about photons to chemical processes to cells to small animals to human physiology, and maybe even all the way up to the global level, we do see that somehow consciousness seems to be involved at every single stage. The kinds of studies that are used tend to be somewhat different, and the size of the effects that we see also are different. But just as one example, on the feeling of being stared at, so that's a common experience, and we, in that case, in the laboratory, we very strictly isolate people so that the person who is being stared at is isolated, but in a room with a camera pointing at them. So the camera is on all the time, and the person who's being stared at doesn't know when somebody's actually looking at them through the camera. So rather than asking them to report when they think they're being looked at, which is something, by the way, that my colleague Rupert Sheldrake has done many experiments like that.
Yeah.
Instead, we wire up the person so we look at their physiology. We look at their heart rate, their pupil dilation, their skin conductance, all kinds of different things, which are indications of what's going on below the level of awareness. And so we have periods where somebody is looking at the camera image of the other person, and then periods where they're not looking. And we look at how physiology changes when the staring is happening versus not. And so I forget how many, maybe 1,000 sessions that have been studied like this using, 3 dozen experiments, something of that sort. And it's quite clear that some people are better at this, both at the staring side and also the receiving side. But overall, the evidence is pretty clear that when you stare at somebody, even if they don't know it, that physiologically you become activated. Your sympathetic nervous system becomes activated. So that's consistent with people say out there in the real world that they just felt agitated somehow and turned around and sure enough, somebody is staring at them.
Yes, that's very common.
Yeah, but this of course is done in a highly controlled circumstance. So again, we can tell maybe out in the world, maybe your peripheral vision saw somebody in a reflection or you heard something, but we get rid of all of those possible explanations and we still see the effect.
Yeah, it's these phenomena are so common, and you as you say here, as you explain, there have been so many experiments conducted and so many trials conducted that are, I mean, rigorously scientifically done. And yet there are so many skeptics still. You mentioned Rupert Sheldrake. I know he's been subject to, I mean, scorn, and he's been mocked because he has, explained that these phenomena are real, like the sense of being stared at, and also dogs knowing when their owner is coming home and things like that. I mean, if these are totally natural phenomena, and there are so many experiments showing that they are real, they're happening, why is he subject to scorn? What's happening here?
Well, a lot of scientists think that these kinds of phenomena, as real, are impossible. That's their belief. So where does that belief come from? It comes from, typically, a scientist has 20 or more years of education, and either these topics are not raised during that time, so that's just never a thing, or it's raised in a negative way, that these things are coincidence and misapprehensions and so on. And so the colleagues have looked at textbooks in psychology and sociology, and mostly in the life sciences, to see how are these kinds of experiences described within textbooks. Almost in every case, there are one or two minor exceptions, but the overall way that these kinds of experiences are portrayed, especially in psychology textbooks, it's that it's wrong. It's not real. It's illusory, or it's coincidence, or something like that. So it's not real. And so if you can imagine 20 years of getting that pounded into your head, and combined with the taboo in the academic world, where you're not supposed to talk about this stuff, not only in psychology, but even in places like religious studies and anthropology, where these kinds of phenomena saturate the anthropological and religious lore, you're not supposed to talk about it. So there's a kind of a large-scale schizophrenia going on, or a taboo, where people can have these experiences, and I know many academics do have these experiences like anybody else, but you cannot talk about it at risk of your career. So you can back up again. Well, where did this come about from? Mostly it came about, I think, during the Enlightenment, when the sciences as we currently know them began to arise. And so the science has a certain worldview called materialism that assumes everything is made out of matter and energy, and that's it. And so you notice I didn't mention something there, like, well, we also have internal experience. And so within the neurosciences, the only way then to understand internal experience is as activity of the brain, because that's all there is. There's a brain thing. There is nothing else in there. Well, this is such a strong, I mean, materialism as a worldview, as a way of thinking about how things work, is extremely powerful. And it's so powerful, it has given rise to technologies that allow us to do this kind of interview, for example. And so
Do you think it's a prerequisite for developing that kind of technology, to have a materialist view?
Well, for developing the technologies that we have today, yeah. Our worldview has allowed us to create technologies based on the worldview that has changed the world radically from where it was 1,000 years ago, or even a few hundred years ago. But it leaves out something. And so now we're in the midst of a renaissance of changing the worldview, because finally it's been recognized that materialism is an extremely powerful and an effective way of understanding reality, but it does not describe everything. So a scientist who's trying to create a theory of everything, like in physics, that's a popular thing to do. If that theory cannot account for our internal experience, then it's not a theory of everything. Mm-hmm. It's a theory of a certain constrained way of thinking about everything, namely the material world. Well, philosophers have been talking about this forever, that there's a big difference here between our apprehension of the physical world, which seems to be out there, versus a philosopher who may be an idealist, who says the only thing we will ever know is our internal experience, and everything else then becomes an inference. It's a pretty good inference, because I think you're probably a real person, and I get touched the screen and it seems like it's really there, and all of those kinds of arguments. But nevertheless, the reality is it's all internal experience. And so this tension has been going on a very long time. And I would say that in the last 30 years, that somehow the philosophy of idealism has begun to penetrate within the sciences. In physics, you see it in physics and psychology and neuroscience, in mathematics, like across the board, you're finding that thought leaders in these fields are saying, maybe we left something out.
And but they seem to start off by becoming panpsychists before they dare to become idealists.
Yes, because panpsychism is comfortable because it's a little bit like a quasi-materialistic way of thinking about consciousness. Yeah. So now we have little consciousness particles out there. They're like the elementary...
But they're still particles.
Yeah, elementary particles of awareness. And they combine in certain ways in complex systems like us. And so we have the sense of awareness because it's what we're made of. So it's like it is a step away from material as non-thinking little particles into thinking particles. So it's a baby step, but it's in a way that is sort of comfortable because we're used to thinking about particles. But I think that eventually there will be another step, which is more towards classical idealism, where somehow the physical world is either emerges out of awareness, or maybe there is no physical world. It's all some kind of projection in some way that we can't really understand very well, but that's okay. We don't understand the physical world all that well either, as evidenced by textbooks changing about every 20 years, sometimes very radically. Like right now, in the midst of cosmology being dramatically changed, not only as a result of dark matter and dark energy, but of galaxies that are way too far away and way too young. And, well, how did that happen? So we see these kinds of really radical changes in our understanding of ourselves and our place in the universe about once a generation. And that's beginning to accelerate as there's more and more information coming along, and will continue to accelerate even more as AI begins to look at large bodies of data in ways that individuals cannot.
Then there is, of course, the policemen and policewomen on Wikipedia and other places and in the media who seem to be very active, and they have quite an influence among, I don't know, politicians and highbrow scientists. But you mentioned before that the general public very well understands these psychic phenomena, for instance. So are these policemen and policewomen on Wikipedia, if we take them as an example, they're not representative of the general public, would you say? So are the materialists today a vocal minority, more or less?
I'm not sure it's a minority. It depends on which population you're talking about.
Yeah.
So let's
talk about the so-called Western world, because I know it's a bit different in places like India and Africa. People think differently there.
Yeah, the culture is a very strong indicator as well. So the materialist police people, I believe, are probably a minority in the sense that they completely reject anything that they imagine is somehow challenging materialism. And so it actually is they portray that they're interested in science, but it's actually an anti-scientific position because they're taking such they're not allowing evidence to be seen for what it is, because they're saying it's impossible, these people are crazy and all that. So the whole effort is ad hominem, largely. That's why it's anti-scientific, and yet I think all it really does is maintain the taboo. That's what it's doing, because when you talk to people in the academic world privately after a couple of beers, everyone eventually reports that they have some kind of experience of this type, and most people are actually interested. So we're also well aware of the taboo. You don't talk about certain things. So just like any taboo, it's sustained by people who are very loud and shouting. Nobody wants to have to face that. Eventually, they will go away. Because you see the same kind of taboos that have been around for a very long time in almost every other field of people doing things, in medicine, in physics, whatever. There's a lot of shouting that happens when existing ideas that have stood the test of time are shown, you know what, that wasn't completely right. Well, if you're the person who's promoting that idea, you don't like to hear that at all because that's attacking you. And so there's a lot of pushback. And in science, that's expected and actually probably even healthy. In the short term, it doesn't feel very good if you're on the right side of history and you're forced to make your case. But that's also the strength of science, that you scream at each other and you provide data and eventually you either convince people or you don't. And sometimes it can take 50 years or more.
So if the materialists, physicalists are shouting louder and louder, that might be a sign that the paradigm is shifting. Would you say that?
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if you have non-scientists who are shouting this the loudest, which are the materialist police.
Michael Shermer and others?
Yeah. Well, people who are professional skeptics. They're maintaining previous ideas and being quite loud and vociferous about it. Being loud doesn't mean it's true. It just means they're being loud about it, or that they have an emotional attachment to this versus that. And of course, and sometimes that's correct. So you'll find like the debates over vaccines. So a lot of people will be very unhappy about vaccines and may be very loud about how they're all trying to get us somehow. And then if you actually look at the science, the majority of people will say, no, actually vaccines are really good, including the COVID vaccine. They're using the same principles as other forms of vaccines, but using new techniques. Well, so you go back in history a little bit and you find people screaming at why we shouldn't use embryonic stem cells or any kind of stem cells. And then people screaming about transplanting organs. And people screaming about this and that all the way back as far as you can go. And of course, some of the more famous examples are the evidence from the British royalty showing that people who ate limes and vitamin C on ships would not get scurvy. And yet it took over 50 years for that empirical evidence to contradict what people thought. And then finally said, oh, okay, it's vitamin C. Now we understand it. Now you could use it. Well, there's lots of examples like that. That's just it just reflects stubbornness that is part of being human, I guess.
Yeah.
And here we're dealing with exactly the same thing.
What about your own Wikipedia page, if you have one, if there is one? Is it being policed by these materialists as well?
Oh yeah. 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 If you look at my Wikipedia page, it would suggest that I'm a fringe character and I get a lot of criticism from the scientific world. And that's it. Like it's completely negative. And I've tried in the past, I tried to change it to say, well, what is said there is true, but of course it's very selective. And what it's not saying is dozens and dozens of well-known scientists, including Nobel laureates, have also supported my work. None of that is allowed. Mm. So it's just, you know, it takes information and presents what should be a neutral, at least a neutral biography of somebody, and it is not that.
Yeah. There's a group called the Guerrilla Skepticism on Wikipedia, I think, about 150 people who are editing like thousands of pages all the time and just policing them. And it's an actual group, and they boast about what they're doing, that they're keeping things tidy and cleaning up the woo-woo, you know.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate not only because the information is very biased, but because that is a source that people go to who otherwise wouldn't know.
Nah, right? And it turns up on the top of search pages when you search on Google, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, so it takes some work to figure out, well, can I trust that as a source or not? And if people don't want to do the homework to find out if it's true or not, then we have a problem. And again, all it's really doing is sustaining a taboo. Taboos do not last forever. So there's a lot of people spending a lot of time and effort, eventually will be forgotten. So, you know, if you're on the edge of science or art or anything, you will always be attacked. People don't like change. And that's simply par for the course. And if you don't like that, then you don't do it, right? I don't like it that there's so much. I don't mind criticism, provided that it's constructive criticism. What I don't like, of course, is criticism that is intended to deflect interest, or criticism that is false or useless. That's not very good. On the other hand, yeah, you're doing something that's considered controversial, that's going to happen. And if you don't like it, you don't do controversial research. You go with the mainstream.
Yeah. Speaking of what is actually known but not talked about, you hear sometimes that the military and the security apparatus have applied psi abilities or psychic phenomena, like remote viewing, for instance, since way back, and at the same time, as we say here, paranormal phenomena or psychic phenomena have been a no-go zone, no-go areas in textbooks and in the mainstream narrative. So do people in power know more about the reality of these phenomena than they tell the public, would you say?
No. No, I mean, the people are people. So a predictable number, probably a majority of people in government and the military and the intelligence world, they have these experiences too. So they know that they're real. The U.S. government and Russia, certainly, probably China and a few other countries, either have had or have programs doing research on these things to see if they could be used for typically for intelligence purposes, espionage. And I also know that other governments are tracking what's going on. There's always some group of people tracking, mainly as a threat analysis. Like, do we need to be worried about what the Chinese are doing about psychic whatever? And so some people are doing that. They've been doing that forever and continue to do that. So one of the reasons, at least within the U.S., where the program that was going for 20 years was highly classified, was because there's a lot of objections from a religious perspective that you shouldn't be doing this. That's quite different from saying this is impossible or doesn't exist. They say, yeah, it completely does exist, but it's demonic.
Yeah.
And so there shouldn't be any government involvement in something that's demonic. And that's because the U.S. is a very religious country with lots of different religions sort of biting at each other all the time. And many of those such people are within the government and the military systems. And so you have a tension that arises in that we need to know if China or Russia or somebody else is actually using these things, because we know that they're real. We need to know that, but we shan't do it. Which, I mean, well, now what do you do? So, yeah. So once the formerly classified program became known and was no longer classified, there was strong pressure to say, well, no, we're not going to do that again, unless it goes back into the deep black world of classified research, and then nobody knows about it anymore. So I used to work on that program, and way back when. So people will ask now, well, is there still a program? There's somebody somewhere trying to figure out what's going on? And my answer is, I don't know, because I'm not in that anymore. And the things that are projects that are in the deep black world are specifically designed to remain secret. And they spend a lot of time and effort to make sure that that is the case. And so even though I'm working directly in this same field, I don't know if there's some other people or project going on. What I can say, though, is I hope so, because are the phenomena real? Yes. Can they be used in some way, either for intelligence or maybe military purposes? Yes. So if we know that, certainly everybody else knows that, and it would be to our advantage to have some kind of program somewhere, at least for no other reason, to keep tabs on what other people are doing.
Yeah. Let's talk about the true nature of reality. Homo sapiens has, it looks a bit over, our species, the species that, that are us, looks a little bit over endowed, you might say. We've had these brains and these this DNA for 200,000, some say even 300,000 years, because they found some skull in Morocco that's 300,000 years old. So anatomically modern humans have looked the same for 200,000 or 300,000 years. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit odd that, I mean, going back that far, having these advanced brains and this advanced DNA, and you know, they talk about junk DNA and all that, is a bit strange that it hasn't been used, that we are so over endowed. Do you think that parts of our DNA has or have been dormant and potentially allow for what we today would call maybe superhuman faculties, if you will?
Yeah, I don't know if it's in DNA or not. There's certainly, now that we understand more about epigenetics, that there are many genes that are either turned on or not turned on, depending on environment and experience. So is there a genetic basis, ultimately, for something like psychic sensitivity? Well, that's one of the projects that we've been working on, to look for people who have psychic ability, who come from psychic families over many generations, because then it suggests that there is some kind of genetic component to it, as compared to people who never report anything psychic and nobody in their family ever reports anything psychic. So we've done a very small scale study looking at the possibility that there is a genetic difference. And so we did find a difference in a very, very small study, only something like 15 people in each category. But we vetted the psychic people to that they had some actual ability and checked that their families did as well. And so the difference that we found was in what's called an intron sequence, a non-coding portion of the DNA. So it's not a portion of the DNA that codes for protein. So the structure that we're built from. So the epigenetics here seems to be the thing that is the difference. So the intron sequence involves turning genes on and off. But it wasn't what we thought. We originally thought we were going to find that the psychics were different than the wild type. The wild type is the name of genes, and it's the average person out there. What we found, though, is that it was the controls. The people who never have any psychic ability, they were the ones who had a mutation in their intron sequence.
Mm.
And this actually kind of matches then what we see worldwide, that the majority of people, the average person out there, has had some of these experiences. The unusual people are the ones who never do. And that's where we found the mutation. So to confirm this, we would need to do a much larger scale study. Like studies that look, for example, at the genetic basis of schizophrenia. They have case control. It's called a case control study, where you have cases that you're interested in and controls that don't have it. You might have 10,000 people, the genetics of 10,000 people on both sides, in order to say what genes are responsible for schizophrenia. And so they have done that. And there are constellations of genes, sometimes dozens or hundreds, that combine to create these differences, psychiatric differences. In a few cases, things like sickle cell anemia, just recently getting approval for a genetic treatment, a cure, actually, there's only a few genes, sometimes one gene, that is mutated. And if you fix that gene using modern methods, that's a cure. The person doesn't have sickle cell anemia anymore, which is amazing. But in these more complicated things like psychic phenomena, we're probably talking about hundreds of genes, so a constellation of genes that are just in the right direction to produce very high psychic talent, because some people have that. And also the other side, where people have no sensitivity of this at all. Because again, we're talking about a spectrum of abilities. So because of my interest in the possible genetic component here, I co-founded a company a couple of years ago to use genetic engineering methods to see, first of all, could we do something that would be useful in psychiatry, just average disorders? But was it possible to do that? And then we would be able to go further down the line to say, well, if we could figure out what is a genetic basis for psychic talent, could we create a method to take a so-called average person and make them into a super psychic by genetic means? So we're still pretty far away from that, but we have created a genetic treatment for mild cognitive impairment, eventually for dementia, and maybe even Alzheimer's. And so we know in animal models that this absolutely works. Like, it's very significant improvement in memory. We think it'll work in humans because we've tested it in human neurons. And eventually down the line, we will probably have a way of enhancing whatever it is that makes somebody talented in the psychic domain as compared to not.
Yeah. Then of course, it's a question whether if it's the chicken and egg problem, and if it's a correlation or a, you know, if it's because of the genes that we have certain abilities, or if the genes are expressing certain abilities that people have. And then, I mean, we enter the discussion about consciousness and what that is, and whether that is primary or not.
Yeah, it is a very interesting thing here, because when I think about how do I best explain why psychic effects would exist, I tend more towards being an idealist from a philosophical point of view, because it's relatively easy then to understand how that could be. On the other hand, we're doing neuroengineering of the brain, very materialistic, and yet there's strong correlations with things like anxiety and a whole bunch of other psychiatric illnesses. Well, we know from the correlations that this is related to that. So anxiety is related to 5-HT2A being hyperactive. This is a certain receptor in neurons. So say, okay, well, if that's actually causal, then what if we downregulated the 5-HT2A receptor? Would that make people feel less anxious? And the answer is yes. They report it. So subjectively, they're reporting something that we did a mechanistic thing in the brain, and people feel less anxious. But we don't even need to go to genetics. You just say, take a Valium. Do you feel less anxious now? Yeah, it works really, really well. So my Valium story is, I've been a meditator for many, many years. And I know that if I do diligent meditation, my level of anxiety will go down. It never goes down as far as taking a single Valium.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I'm not meditating well, or maybe I'm taking Valium, it's effective in me. But subjectively, I know that I can push my internal mental state to a pretty good degree, just purely mentally, but I cannot push it as far as I can with drugs.
Yeah, so materialism, idealism, 1-0 in that case.
Well, so that's why on the weekends, I'm a materialist, the other way around. On the weekends, I'm an idealist.
Yeah.
During the week, I'm much more either a materialist or a dual aspect monist, because dual aspect monism allows both of them to be true at the same time. So there is a mental world, but there's also a physical world, and they're tightly correlated with each other. Yeah. That's like easy way of thinking of dual aspect monism. It's monistic in that it's not like Descartes' dualism. It's not saying they're two separate things, or saying there is one thing, and they appear in two different ways, probably many ways. But the appearance is, or whatever that one thing is that we don't know, it can appear as a mental thing. It can appear as a material thing, and they have slightly different rules, but they're also tightly correlated.
Yeah.
That's why I can meditate and feel less anxious, or I can take a Valium and feel less anxious. They're operating from different directions, one from the material side and one from the mental side, and the correlation is very, very tight.
Yeah. Super interesting. What have you heard of? Of course, you've heard of, but what do you think of what's called terminal lucidity?
Yeah, that's a big puzzle.
Yeah, that's a puzzle. It's correlated, of course, also connected to near-death experiences, but this is a very particular kind of that thing. People who have had Alzheimer's or their they have dementia or Alzheimer's, and then just a couple of days or so before they are to die, they are lucid. They become lucid. They recognize all their relatives, and they can speak freely, and they remember things. And it's a mystery, really. For a materialist, it's a mystery. For an idealist, it's not that mysterious, I guess.
Yes, it's less difficult to understand from an idealist perspective. The thing about terminal lucidity, now sometimes called paradoxical lucidity, I know at least one person who said that they had a family member who was in coma and Alzheimer's and whatever, and in bed for a long time, and shortly before dying got out of bed, which they shouldn't have been able to do because your muscles get very weak, got out of bed, said hello to everybody. They were all stunned to see that the person was actually walking around and talking to people and whatever, and then they went back to bed and they died. That's pretty close to impossible. And it really pushes not only on the mental side, but on the physical side too. So what's making things happen? So the short answer is we don't know. We really don't know. What I do know is I often question, what are the limits then of psychic ability? Where does it end? And I used to think, well, these things are pretty weak and they're difficult to see in the laboratory. And occasionally there's a strong experience that somebody will have, which could even be transformative. But what about on the mind-matter interaction side? See, I'm testing photons in a little box. Well, that's pretty small stuff. So friends of mine who would go to metal bending parties, like spoon bending parties,
the Uri Geller thing.
Yeah. And they would show me what they did, and I would say, yeah, it's, you know, they didn't know their own strength or something like that. And it's relatively easy. If you take a teaspoon and you can bend it at the neck, and like anybody could do that. So I had an opportunity to attend one of these parties, and I knew that what would be interesting would be to see somebody do something that was physically not possible, even with dissociated strength. And so one of the things then is to bend the bowl of a heavy soup spoon in half. You can't do that with ordinary strength. And yet I did it. So that's my spoon. Oh. So it's a heavy soup spoon. Cool. I bent it and I was holding it. It didn't bend by itself, but I just squished it over. And I checked my fingers immediately to see if I had used strength, which I know I can't do it, but nevertheless, I checked. There was no indication of indentation, and my fingers didn't hurt and all the rest of it. It happened. So this is why one of the quotes I like is from William Crookes, the inventor of the Crookes tube and lots of other things having to do with plasma, in fact, named and invented the idea of plasma. And so when people are asking him, well, why do you believe in all this physical mediumship stuff? Because he did a lot of studies there too. And he said, well, I don't believe it. I didn't say I believed it. I just said it happened. Well, so that's the same thing that, like, with this. Like, I don't know what I believe about this, but it happened because there it still is. This was like 20 years ago and it hasn't changed.
Yeah.
Cool. So I don't know what the limits are.
I think some martial arts apply that kind of abilities that you were just displaying here.
Yeah,
you can, and it's actually I've tried this myself. I haven't bent any thick spoons or anything, but just this simple thing that you imagine that your arm is made of steel. You just imagine that it's banal, really, but just by doing that go with the game, and you might think it's ridiculous, but you just do it. Okay. It's made of steel. Then you can have people hanging on it that weigh, you know, like 140 pounds. And it's, you would never be able to do that if you didn't imagine that your arm was made of steel. It's really fascinating and so simple. I don't know how it works.
Yeah. Well, nobody does.
So, yeah, I wanted to ask you about something here that I think you already answered, really. As a matter of fact, if we if you think that we threw out the baby with bathwater when science split from religion some 400 years ago, and if a reunion is possible, you talked about this already in the beginning of our conversation. But if a reunion would be possible, what would be the catalyst here? Would it be the research on consciousness that's intensifying now, or would it be size studies, or would it be something else?
That's a very good question. Yeah, what is it that breaks the taboo?
Yes,
that's part of it. Well, if you look back at literature on consciousness studies, you find that there's a little bump that happened in the 60s and 70s. Well, why did that happen? It's because of the psychedelic revolution. And so I think now, because psychedelics are coming back, there are more and more people who are beginning to recognize that our sense of reality is a construction, and it's relatively easy to disrupt that construction and begin to experience all kinds of other things. So fortunately, there are enough studies now showing that psychedelics are useful for treating depression and other psychiatric problems, that it won't go away this time. It'll still be controlled in some way because it's powerful stuff, but nevertheless, it won't be abused and controlled like it was back in the 60s. Well, so that opens that, combined with meditation going mainstream, both of those are causing more and more people to directly experience that, not only just psychic things that happen spontaneously, but other things that happen and increasingly as a result of mentally being in different spaces. And so I think that's going to continue. It'll stick around. It will change an entire generation or two of people, some of whom will become academics. And we can already see the results of this. So for example, the reason why the project that we mentioned called Sigil is called that is because some of the participants on it were recruited specifically because they use magical methods. They use sigils. They use other whatever magical methods they want to use as a way of enhancing their ability to do the experiment. So I'll be comparing people who use, say, meditation as their tool as compared to people using magic. So it's a way of kind of testing magical methods. Well, so now at the University of South Carolina in the United States, you can get a master's degree in magic.
Wow.
And a sister program at the University of Exeter in the UK, you can get a master's degree in magic. Eventually, those will become doctoral programs. So you can get a doctorate in magic. Well, what does that even mean? It means that within the realm of religious studies, of which, of course, is very long term, has been interested in esoteric ideas and practices. But because of the taboo, if somebody is a scholar in that area, they can talk all day long about beliefs in magic, but they can't suggest that it's actually real. That's beginning to change. And so this is like just one indicator of many that because of a rising interest in all aspects of consciousness studies, including in hard science, that eventually the taboo will break. And so one of the things that I've been predicting for a long time is not only is this change in consciousness happening now, but that the development of quantum biology will provide a semi-materialistic, plausible way for why we have capacities that we call psychic. It's because the brain is operating partially or maybe largely in quantum terms, in which case you are not completely just here. You're spread out in space and time. And if that were true, then there should be some aspects of our perception, at least, which can gain things from a distance in space or time. So suddenly the whole perceptual side of psychic phenomena become easy to understand. And by the same token, if we're dealing with quantum phenomena, then gaining information from a quantum system will change its behavior. Well, now we have a way of understanding why mind-matter interaction works as well. So I think that is, we're on the cusp of seeing people, we already do see articles coming out now saying the brain operates in quantum ways, and this is how we know that this is true. That 30 years ago was a very, very fringy idea, because people would calculate that, no, you could only maintain quantum coherence for a femtosecond, and that's not long enough.
Well, yeah, that's the objection to Roger Penrose's idea of consciousness being produced in the microtubules or whatever.
Yeah, and can be sustained for a long time. And not only that, the quantum coherence is in the brain is a dynamic system. It is going to be constantly recreating coherence all the time, so you can create it as long as you wish. Well, that's, you know, in the laboratory, when you're working with individual photons, like in a physics lab, they're not dealing with it in a dynamic way. So living systems can take advantage of these kinds of phenomena in ways that inanimate systems cannot. And so we're learning now that if nature provides a much more efficient way of doing things, then will it have been ignored by millions of years of evolution? Probably not.
No.
Because it provides that much more ability to survive. Just taking kind of a very mainstream Darwinian approach to it, but it's probably true also.
Yeah. Ties in with the question I asked before about DNA being dormant and all that. Do you think that if the floodgates now open, or at least the taboo is being lifted and taken away, do you think that people, just by virtue of that, that the taboo is lifted, will be able to develop spontaneously, perhaps, more and more deeply seeded psychic abilities, and be able to achieve things, know things, experience things that they weren't able to do before?
I think so, yeah. Because one of the factors that determines the degree to which we see things in the laboratory in this domain is belief. Like, what you're limited by your beliefs. So if now we have a plausibility case and maybe some evidence and theories saying we know this is the case because of X, Y, and Z, that will dramatically increase societal belief. And that will then, it's maybe not a floodgate, but it's a trickle gate. It's a new way of thinking about these phenomena that people were reluctant to talk about because they were afraid of what people would think, rather than, no, oh, okay, well, it's something that everybody just accepts. That's a very dramatic change. What's interesting, though, is that we mentioned before that in different cultures, people have different feelings about this stuff, completely independent of all this. So when I visited India, I gave a talk at a university in their department of cognitive neuroscience, very materialistic. And yet when I was talking to the head of the department, he had a statue of Ganesha and a bunch of other things that are traditional Indian. And after he heard my talk on telepathy, I said, well, everyone asked really good questions. The faculty are interested, the graduate students, you think you would start a program on that? And the answer was no. And which surprised me, because they completely accept it. Like, there's no problem with telepathy. It didn't fit the constraints of the discipline. You don't study telepathy in cognitive neuroscience. That's not part of the discipline. Well, what I should have asked, but I didn't think of it at the time, was, well, what if there was a discipline? Let's call it psychophysics or something like that. Well, and then that would be the discipline. We study that. And I'm sure he would have said that would be no problem. So it's about how do you language what's happened? How do you talk about what you do? And I'd forgotten that within the academic world, if you're working in a discipline, it is a silo. And certain things are allowed in the silo and certain things are not allowed in the silo, just by virtue of the way that the academic world works. So, okay, we create a new discipline. We won't call it parapsychology because that is already associated with too many things. We'll call it psychophysics or psychophysical something or other, some other name. And then people say, oh, yeah, I work in that, and it's no big deal.
Sounds like a good idea. Maybe we should cross-pollinate more than we do. And I mean, all these academic disciplines are a bit strange, aren't they? I mean, after all these years, we see more
but,
that
understandably, they stuck together. No, understandably so. The reason the silos exist is because pick any topic, and you could easily spend lifetimes studying that topic, because the more that you know, the more you realize what you don't understand. And so any topic, there's no topic that is going to be studied for a long time by a lot of people where everybody suddenly says, well, now we understand it all. You just, and so that's why these silos keep getting deeper and deeper. And when you do that, you spend a lifetime knowing about these very thin slices of reality, and you cannot spend the time to jump to other disciplines. In my career, I've jumped many, many times, medicine and physics and statistics and engineering and psychology and whatever, all lots of different things.
You're a case in point of the contrary here.
Well, yeah, but also I got out of the academic world because I couldn't stand it after a while. So yeah. Why wouldn't you want to study that? Yeah. Well, because it's not part of what we do. And I didn't want that constraint.
No.
So
I understand. Yeah, so I'm the same way. So where should people go now if they want to know more about you and your amazing work that you do and IONS?
Well, so the IONS website is noetic.org. noetic.org. My personal website is deanraden.com.
And don't go to the Wikipedia.
Well, you could look at it, but you contrast the biography that I wrote on my own website with the one on Wikipedia, and you'll see there's a bit of a contrast.
Good idea. Yeah. Okay, I'll put links in the description as always. Dean Raden, it's been a pleasure and an enlightenment to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining.
You're welcome.
If you like this video, don't forget to subscribe and don't forget to hit that like button and share the video with your friends. Please support the channel if you can. I appreciate all the support. You can become a Patreon for as little as $1 a month, or you can make a one-off donation via PayPal if you wish. All the links are in the description box below. Thank you.